Pretty good, Paul?
Yeah.
It's been pretty good.
That was darn good, too. I mean, beef 10 different ways.
Good morning, everyone. I would like to warmly welcome you all to this House Committee on Transportation Policy this very icy Friday, February the 3rd, 2017. I'm delighted to have with us this morning our ODOT staff to enlighten us on a number of things. Talk to us about the DMV, about motor carriers, and then Mr. Gard is here to talk to us about rail. So I'm going to go ahead and open an informational meeting and invite ODOT staff up in any particular order. Please feel free to come in any order you choose to enlighten us about some topics that are going to be germane to everything we do in this committee for the rest of the sessions.
Great.
Thank you for being here. I did get some pings this morning from some folks who are interested in our two bills who were having trouble getting out of Portland. So we will put you all on first and see if it gives them enough time to find their way safely down here. If not, we may need to make some adjustments in our schedule and later in the committee meeting because travel has become dicey this morning. So, and thank you all for being here. Ladies and gentlemen.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll kick it off. My name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV Administrator. And we do have a couple others to round out our overview of DMV. You've got to start on that Wednesday, first thing, 8 o'clock, first day. And we're back to give brief overviews of what we do in our divisions and take any questions that you have as well. So I appreciate the opportunity to share some information about the Oregon DMV. Again, Tom McClellan, DMV Administrator. I've been at DMV for about 20 years and administrator about 9 years, so a little bit of experience with the organization. DMV is frequently referred to as the face of state government. And the reason for that is we have so much contact with the general public. We serve businesses, nonprofits. A lot of different individuals have the opportunity to come in contact with our agency, our division of ODOT, and we take that very, very seriously. We take that as a very important responsibility that we have. That first impression of Oregon and Oregon state government is frequently through a DMV, through an office or a phone call to us. We're expected to deliver a broad range of services and products. However, our mission statement distills this down to what I consider a three-legged stool of three things that are most important to us. Our mission is to promote driver safety, to protect financial and ownership interests in vehicles, and to collect revenue to finance Oregon's multimodal transportation system. We completed a strategic plan last year, and we discerned the following vision statement for our organization: to be a nimble and easily accessible DMV, recognized for serving customers through innovation, efficiency, and dedicated employees. We boil all this down to an easily memorized service motto for our employees: exceeding expectations, one customer at a time. Very easy, just flows right off the tongue. So we use that to reinforce those values. The third leg of the stool is revenue collection. We collect about $700 million each biennium from driver licenses, vehicle registration and titles, driver testing, ID cards, specialty group registration plates, and other services. Our revenue is used to cover our operating expenses, plus is generally dedicated to state and local transportation system funding under Article 9 of the Oregon Constitution. Over the past 16 years, the legislature has raised DMV fees for investments in Oregon's transportation system rather than for cost recovery at DMV. The increases shown on the chart result from fee increases for the Oregon Transportation Investment Acts, which Mr. Mather, I think, mentioned to you a couple days ago. In 2001, 2002, and 2003, there were significant increases in our fees dedicated to those construction projects. Plus, in 2009, the Jobs and Transportation Act. These revenues were dedicated primarily for payment of principal and interest on bonds issued for transportation infrastructure projects. The top-line revenue forecast for future years is flat at approximately $700 million. The dark shaded area of the bar chart depicts DMV base revenues for operations, which are relatively unchanged since 2001-2003. The strategic plan that I just referenced identifies five strategic priorities for the next 2 years. I'd like to highlight three of those priority areas. First is continuous improvement. We are challenging ourselves to develop systems and skills that enable constant innovation. We enable employees at DMV to develop and apply their capabilities to drive and achieve value-adding change and improvements. Second area is leveraging technology. We need to replace outdated computer systems and the tools that our employees use to enable more efficient business processes and easier access to our services. We must purchase and create flexible business systems that can respond to changing customer, stakeholder, and employee needs. And the third area that I really want to emphasize is our employees and our culture. We must strengthen our practices and our culture at all levels to ensure we develop our people, that we welcome diversity, we empower decision-making at the appropriate levels, constantly focusing on serving our customers, remain open to change and innovation, and act with integrity and professionalism. Those three areas, I think, are very important for us in the future. Customer service delivery, obviously, is very important to our organization. Our primary services include driver licensing and the managing of the driving privilege that goes along with that, registering and titling vehicles, and providing other services that generate revenues for other purposes. Our driver license and ID card issuance is about 600,000 per year. Vehicle registration is about 1.9 million per year. And the titles, about 1 million per year. It's a pretty high volume for an organization of our size. Services are offered through five primary delivery channels, online or internet, telephone, mail, third-party providers, and in person at our 60 geographically dispersed field offices around the state. Let's go back just one. Other revenues, I wanted to also mention this, other revenues that we collect, a portion of our revenue for ID cards goes toward transit, senior and disabled transit. Custom plates, a portion of that revenue goes toward trains and rail in the state. A portion of our driver license fee that we collect, $6 of that goes to driver education for teens in the state. State parks benefits from RV licenses. We, of course, sell specialty and group plates, which colleges and universities and veteran groups and others benefit from those things as well. So some of the things that we measure, kind of key performance indicators for us, first is, and probably foremost, is our field office wait times. People really seem to care about how long they have to wait at a DMV office. Our goal is that 70% of the customers receive, at least they initiate their service with us within 20 minutes of walking in the door. That's our goal, at least 70% of the people statewide at those 60 offices. Our results in 2015, we were about 65% of people started that transaction within 20 minutes. Last year, it was in fiscal year 16, it dropped to 61%. We're a little higher than that this year. In fact, last month, I think we were right at 70% statewide. So that's it's a stretch goal still for us to get to that point, but it's out there for us to try to achieve.
Tom, is there a seasonal curve there?
It actually
slow
does.
Down, yeah.
It does change. It does change. We try to staff up in the summers for the increased number of people that come through the door through temporaries and things like that. But it does have some seasonal, some cyclical variation to it. Not as much as we used to see. We've noticed more of a plateauing, I guess. It's high, and it's kind of constantly high, it feels like. So a lot of people coming through the door.
Thank you.
Another one is call wait times. Our goal is to answer those calls within 45 seconds. We don't want people waiting very long to talk to somebody. So 45 seconds is our goal. In fiscal year 15, we were right at 45 seconds. Last fiscal year, it rose to 63 seconds, so a little over a minute. We're right on target to meet or exceed that 45 seconds this current fiscal year. We operate three customer contact centers, and we take in about 1.5 million calls each year. Again, pretty high volume. Title production, our goal is to produce a title, get it out the door within 21 days. In 2015, that was just under 25 days, and in 2016, it rose to 31 days. So a real concern for us that it takes that long to get the title produced. Our goal is to get that mailed within that 21 days. And we produce over 100,000 vehicle ownership documents each month, and making some progress in that this fiscal year to try to lower that number. Other services that we provide, we have dealer business licensing and regulation. All the new and used car dealers in the state receive a certificate, a license through us, and we do inspections and we regulate those businesses throughout Oregon. We also assist with voter registration, organ and tissue donor designations. We help veterans find benefits. There's a lot of things we do that you may not think of with DMV until I remember they asked me if I wanted the D on the card. That's another part of what we do at DMV. We also are a collection point for the crash and accident reporting in the state. We ensure compliance with the automobile liability insurance reporting. We issue snowboard permits, trip permits, disabled placards. I mean, the list goes on. There's a lot of things that we're charged with doing. Customer satisfaction. This is measured in a number of ways, but primarily through a monthly survey of 400 randomly selected people who've been in a DMV field office the previous month. Oregon State University handles the survey for us, and we get about a 35% response rate each month, which is actually pretty good as far as returning that. What it tells us is that over 90%, almost month over month, 90% of people who respond to that survey rate us as good or excellent in the areas of employee courtesy, helpfulness, efficiency, ability to answer questions, all those people side components of customer service. We're rated very, very high, consistently every month. Now, wait time satisfaction doesn't go quite as high as that, but it's 60%, well over half, are saying good or excellent. And what we find with that monthly survey is the quantitative part is interesting and valuable. It's the written comments that are really, really insightful that we can look through. And we find that people from other states, especially California, really rate us quite high on all areas, especially the wait time aspect, because the wait time in Oregon is far less than places like California. Some of the actions that we've taken, we are now posting our wait times on our website, almost up to the minute. So if you go to our website and pull up any of the offices that have our wait time systems, there are about 37, 38 of the 60 have those systems, the larger offices. You can see what the current wait time is in that office. You can make a decision, especially in the Portland area, which of those Portland area offices you want to go to. Factor in your travel time, look at the wait time, what's the best deal for me, and choose that. It helps with balancing a bit as well as far as the number of people walking through the door. They can decide where they want to go.
Tom, I'm sorry, I have one other question while we're on this topic. How are we incentivizing people to use your website instead of going into a bricks and mortar? Is that changing over time or is it static?
Madam Chair, we don't have a lot of services we provide online.
You can
but those that we do,
you can
the
renew.
Primary one would be the vehicle registration renewal. Mm-hmm. That grows about 1-2% of the total, the percentage of the registration renewals. It's growing gradually. Okay. We're up to like 22% or 23% of people are choosing to do that instead of primarily mailing it in. The percentage that go to a field office seems to be relatively static at about a third. Okay. There's a lot of reasons for that. You know, different communities, people just prefer to go in face-to-face and do the service, or people don't want to use their credit card or, you know, over the internet. There's a lot of reasons for that. But we don't have a lot of incentives necessarily, financial. We don't give them Starbucks cards or anything like that for doing it. But it is gradually growing over time.
Thank you.
Other things we've done in our field offices, we now accept debit and credit cards in all 60 of our offices as of September of last year. And that's because of a budget approved by the legislature in 2015 to allow us to pay for the merchant fees. We have greeters in our lobbies that review documents in most of our larger offices, ensuring that people have what they need when they walk in the door instead of finding out 20 or 30 minutes after they've been sitting there that they don't have what they need. So in many of the offices, we greet them when they first come in the door. Some offices, we will send people out even before 8 o'clock when we open to with clipboards and ask people, what do you have, what do you need, and make sure they're ready when they walk in the door. In 2014, there was a customer service task force that was formed at the request of this body. The legislature asked us to convene a group. It had several legislators on it. Some of the recommendations that they made, first and foremost, was replace your computer systems. Very old systems. If you want to be better in the future, replace the systems. Accept credit and debit cards, which we have done. Increase fees to pay for technology and credit and debit merchant fees. We did not do that. We did raise that as an option 2 years ago with the legislature, but that did not happen to pay for it. Posting wait times online, which we have done. Allow online registration renewal receipts as proof of tag replacement. That was a law passed in 2015, which if a person is pulled over and their tags are expired, they can pull that receipt out and say, well, I did renew. Here's evidence of that. The tags are on the way. Law enforcement can accept that at the side of the road. They may choose not to, but they can, at least by state law, accept that, which is another way to encourage people to renew online because it's frequently a last-minute decision. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have expired tags, so I go to the field office. So those are the types of things they recommended. One was installing a lobby management system in our field offices. We have not done that, but we are actively investigating that as a possibility for the more efficient queuing of people through the offices. So some of the issues, trends, maybe challenges that we're facing right now, one would be the growing demand for services. Oregon's economy, thankfully, has been doing quite well. We're one of the top in-migration states in the country. With that means more DMV service, more transactions, more customer visits for driver licenses, ID cards, titles, registration. We're seeing that growth. It's definitely happened since 2009 period, continuous growth, and our staffing doesn't grow with it. We're not a private business that can just add more people as the business increases. That's a struggle, as you saw in the service levels. A big part of that is the transactions. The workload has grown up, gone up. Staffing has not.
Could you, that's interesting. We are having a significant in-migration, and it's interesting that they're happy with our services because they're coming from states that were more challenging. Could you give us a sense of where, with our registration fees and such, where we stack up with the other 50 states as far as what the costs are?
Chair McEwen, our fees tend to be on the lower end of things, and we actually have a ranking of all the states. If you'd like to have that, we can provide that to you.
Sure,
both title and registration. It depends on the type of vehicle. Oregon does not have an ad valorem fee, and kind of a sales tax, basically, that's tacked on, which other states do. California in particular, when you do the registration, it's based on the value of the vehicle. So their rates can be much, much higher than what you pay in Oregon. We can provide that to you if you'd like to see.
That would be interesting to have. The other thing is the technology piece. I know that antiquated technology is something that you struggle with, and there's conversation about investing in new computer systems. Where are we on that, and what's the investment need? What's the time frame? Because I know that impacts our customers tremendously.
Chair McEwen, that's a lead into one of my next slides.
Oh, perfect.
I'm moving to that.
All right.
That's
I'm
my punchline.
Perfect.
I'll get right to that. If that's
right,
gonna be okay.
Thank you.
So another issue I wanted to cover is the Federal Real ID Act, another challenge potentially for us. That's a major policy issue for the legislature, and it appears that there will be some revisiting of a 2009 decision by the legislature that essentially said we would not comply. We were told no state funds could be used. We were told make sure that there's a security of all personal identifiable information, ensure that would be the case if you're going to try to comply, do a cost analysis. There were a number of steps that were built into this, gates, if you will, and essentially just told us don't even try to comply with the Federal Real ID Act. Well, there are some dates coming up here that I just want to make sure you're aware of. There is an enforcement schedule that the Department of Homeland Security issued a couple of years ago. All secure federal facilities, there's a look for a card from a compliant state or a state that has an extension. For TSA, at airports, for boarding commercial flights, the date for that is in January 22nd of 2018, less than a year. TSA will be looking for someone from a card of a state that's issuing a compliant card or a state with a deferral of some kind. And then by October 1st of 2020, they'll be looking for a card that is specially marked as compliant, like a gold star or black star, something on the card that's in October of 2020. Oregon status, we have deferral status until June 6th of this year. So it's right near the end of your session. That's when the deferral goes. We would probably have some period of time, some kind of grace period after that, if we didn't see much progress or change, is what they're really looking for. We were asked for a report by the Legislative Emergency Board. We're in the final stages of having that report available to you around some options there and implications of not making changes as well. Maybe some communication you'd want us to do with the general public in Oregon about these timelines and what the effect might be. But there are some options. And I understand there's three bills that have been introduced on Real ID as well.
So trying to solve the problem.
Yeah.
But isn't the ultimate effect that you will try and board a plane and they won't let you on?
Madam Chair, it's they're going to look for a different document. Do you have a passport, a U.S. passport or a passport card? You have a fairly long list of other documents that are available to certain people. Not everyone would
if
be
you have them.
Yeah, available.
But there's an expense to that as well.
And there's
for
an expense
our customers,
to it as well.
Yeah.
And what we've been told is they most likely will not turn people away, but there may be an alternative pat-down process or some other process that they're putting people through if you don't have one of those cards or some that acceptable identification. Okay.
Well, instead of TSA pre-check, it's going to be TSA pre-check a whole lot more?
It could be.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how they'll market that.
I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this. And do you recall the cost associated with the work that we need to do to comply?
It's all in the report.
Okay, great.
And we've factored in both the IT components and also the workload associated with it and the staffing that we anticipate would be needed to prevent the wait times from just going through the roof, because it could definitely change the number of people coming through the door outside of the 8-year cycle. That's the issue. If someone wants a compliant card and they still have 4 years left in their license, they may want to come in and get a replacement card and go through a whole, a little more rigorous maybe, and bring their birth certificate again to DMV for us to make a copy of it. That's one of the provisions we don't do today. We don't keep an image of the person's identity document that they present to us, and the Real ID does require that.
And we may invite you back when we have a little bit more time to talk about that a little bit more. But thank you.
And so, Madam Chair, the last thing is aging computer systems. Our mainframe systems were written primarily in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Not that we've been standing still all that time, but that's when they were first created. And technology is the biggest barrier to achieving the DMV vision that I described for you of becoming more responsive and nimble in the way we deliver services. So the service transformation program is what we're calling this. We're implementing a commercial off-the-shelf solution, some system that's been built, installed successfully in another state, bringing it to Oregon, and adjusting our practices to match what that particular system is able to do. It'll enable DMV core business processes to be improved. More online self-service options is envisioned as well through that. It's estimated to take 9 to 10 years, and we're a couple years into that now, at an estimated cost of $90 million. The 2005 legislature approved funding at $32 million for this current biennium and about 42 positions to get going on it. We won't spend $32 million this two-year period. It was more of a cash flow basis of where we're at with our vendors. It'll be closer to, I think, 10, maybe 12 million of the 32. But we do have a request in for about $45 million in the next biennium, all moving toward that $90 million total price tag. Business case, our current systems and technology environment is outdated, it's fragmented, highly inefficient, and it's difficult to use and to learn. 95% of our systems are in COBOL, not a modern programming language these days. Many of our experienced employees are retiring with knowledge of the systems and the processes, and it's important to acquire something and move quickly to get new systems in place. We've made good progress in the time that we've had this biennium. We've staffed up. We're doing some planning. We've identified over 2,200 business requirements that we've given to the COTS, commercial off-the-shelf vendor, who said that they can meet those 2,200-plus requirements and others as well. We started our data migration and cleansing work. That's one of the big things we found from other states is it's data. Problems with inconsistencies in names and addresses and things like that in different systems. So we're cleaning that up, truing it up so that we can have a single system where it all works. Governance is a big part of what we're doing. We have a legislative oversight task force. We have, of course, the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology that we report to regularly. ODOT has an executive steering committee chaired by Director Garrett. All kinds of oversight, quality assurance, state CIO's office. A lot of folks are interested in what we're doing, and we're keeping them informed as best we can of our project. And we are in negotiations with COTS vendor. They'll be on site on Monday and Tuesday next week for really kicking that off. So we're really on schedule and doing very, very well. The next steps are to finalize that contract, add internal subject matter experts to the project, and roll out the first major system during the next biennium, the 17-19 period. It'll most likely be our vehicle system that we replace. That's the end of my presentation. So,
thank you.
Yes, Representative McLean.
We have to do the technology update and that, and especially because of the ID card and everything else, but one of the issues that seem to be coming up everywhere, even with the new technology and driverless cars and a lot of other things, is privacy issues. And so I wondered where in your group of committees and advisors and folks that you're trying to get reflections on system changes, are you talking about privacy and what are some of those issues that you personally have identified? One of them was the example of keeping documents that definitely are personal documents of someone bringing them into you, and then now they're somewhere out there in the cloud. So just what are the privacy conversations and or challenges that you see facing?
Chair McEwen, Representative McLean, that's a constant challenge for any organization, to tell you the truth. We also, the state CAO takes that very seriously, and there's a lot of work around security right now. So we plan to take advantage of all of that around the firewalls and controls there. We also have on this legislative task force that I mentioned two private sector CIOs who have also been advising us on a number of things. Very good to have that perspective, sitting around the table and looking at what we're doing and making recommendations. So concerns about actual images of documents, but also all that information, personal identifiable information that you have to collect as part of a DMV. So we know that's very, very important.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple of questions that, if not today, that's fine. One is, from my time spent living outside the state because of the military service, I know that a lot of folks who've never actually been to Oregon or have only been to Oregon a couple of times have cars registered in Oregon because of the very competitive registration rates. I was wondering if there'd ever been discussion of having a program where people who live in Oregon for more than X number of months a year would get a rebate, perhaps, and the price might reflect that. The second thing is, you said calls returned in a short period of time. Do you have any contracted call services, and if so, are they in Oregon?
Chair, Representative Evans, the first question I probably would get back to you on, we really haven't thought too much about that
option. I think there's an opportunity
there. Other states would like us to clamp down a bit on the other states' residents that are paying for Oregon registration, not theirs.
I'm just thinking a rebate for going in to actually live here, not charging people unfairly, just a rebate for those that are.
What was the second question?
Second one's about calls being...
Yes, and that 45-second target is to answer the call, not to return a call. I think you said return. It's actually the incoming calls you put on hold, and we answer the call within 45
seconds.
Standard's
very good. I'm wondering, do you have call service, contracted services that are outside the state of Oregon?
Yes, I mentioned we have three call centers. One is staffed with state employees. Two are located in the correctional facilities in the state.
Okay.
They're all within the bounds of the state of Oregon, I think.
Yes, they are. We don't outsource it beyond the state or internationally or anything
Chair,
that.
Chair, this is a reason for the
Oregon.
Question. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that great answer, because a year ago there was a concern having to do with something that went through the Secretary of State's office, and I got to talk to a very nice lady in North Carolina wondering why a state program was doing that. And I just want to assure constituents that heard about things like that to the greatest extent possible, we actually are using sources inside the state of Oregon.
Right.
So thank you for that answer.
And one of the things we also do is when you call the local number for your DMV, it's routed automatically to a call center. You're not actually talking to someone in the field office. We did that several years ago to eliminate that conflict, basically. Do I serve the person in person, who's there in front of me, or do I answer the phone? So those phones are now routed to the call centers as well.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chair.
Do you know how many of our correctional facility residents are working in that capacity?
Chair McEwen, it varies, but 50, 55 approximately is what we try to keep it at between the two locations.
Okay.
We've had a relationship with the women's prison, now Coffee Creek, for probably over 20 years, a very long time. And but we were very restricted in what type of transactions they can do. Very, very restricted. It's very tight. But there's a lot of questions they can answer too. Like office locations, office hours, information about reinstating driving privileges. There's just a lot of things they can answer, and they do a bang up job, a fantastic job. Very, very efficient. And
that's it. You're also building a skill.
Yeah.
And they're building skills.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a procrastinator, I found myself in your Lancaster Mall office right before session, getting plate stickers for two different vehicles, including the time that it took me to go through two lines and write out my check. I was in and out within 15 minutes. That is incredibly fast service.
Great.
That's great.
Thank you.
Kudos. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, I'm gonna take a break for just a moment. Would you mind? We have Representative Lively here to speak to a bill. Would you mind if we bring him to the dais? Do you, and then we'll bring you back up when we're done. I need to have him sit back here while he has things to do.
Thank you.
I'm going to make sure I get this done correctly. Representative Lively, come join us. I'm going to recess. I can just close. Do I close it or recess it? The informational hearing.
Close it.
I'm going to close the informational meeting from the Oregon Department of Transportation and open a public hearing on House Bill 2403. And we have Representative Lively here joining us.
Thank you.
And I think we'll let Mr. Walker give us a little update on what we're trying to talk about here.
Thank Chair, you. Members of the committee, House Bill 2403 requires drivers to exchange the name of the insurance carrier and the insurance policy number to the insurance policy insuring the motor vehicle involved in an accident. Current law does not require that this information be exchanged, and this bill would change that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, committee members, my name is John Lively. I'm State Representative from House District 12, which is Springfield. I'm pleased to be here this morning on this side.
Welcome back to Transportation,
thank
Representative.
Thank you. I appreciate that. To talk about this bill. So on December 22nd of 2016, after I had picked up my truck from the dealer where it had some service done, and I started down Main Street, I stopped at 14th and Main at a light and was subsequently smashed. Somebody 30 miles an hour behind me chose not to stop at the light. Now, there's all kinds of reasons the person chose not to stop, and I think there were legitimate reasons, don't get me wrong. In this particular case, what happened was once we got our wits about us and got out of the middle of Main Street, because that was not a very good place to transact business, the person that ran into me, he immediately got out the driver's license, the registration card, and the insurance card and handed them to me. That was my assumption of how the law always was supposed to be and what we were supposed to be doing. So in my case, it was a pretty easy transaction. The person was very upset about having run into me, was concerned about whether I was injured, made sure I had the documents I needed, and in fact, later that day, recontacted me because the insurance card was due to expire on December 26th, and this was the 22nd, and they had already chosen new insurance and provided me the information on the new insurance without me asking the questions or doing it, because they thought that was their responsibility under the law. That was always my understanding. Now, you have, before you meet, you've probably seen the letter from Don Combs, who that did not occur when his vehicle was in an accident with a driver. The driver, because it was not required to, the driver provided little or no information, and being able to obtain that information to settle with the insurance was a pretty long process involving multiple attempts to land the insurance. When they finally got to the point, unfortunately, in this case, there was no insurance. The person was an uninsured driver, so that didn't solve the problem. I have two other constituents who have had similar incidents. In both cases, though, when they were able to ultimately determine that there was insurance and get a copy of the insurance that was out. But in some cases, in one particular case, it took 2.5 months, and the person, in the 2.5 months, their car was disabled when they were trying to resolve the fact of who's responsible and who the insurance was. So all this bill is an attempt to put in statute that besides providing your driver's license information, if you're in a vehicle accident, that you're required to also furnish proof of insurance to the other people that are involved in the accident. Something that, again, I thought was always required anyway, and fortunately the person that ran into me thought it was required too because she provided that information to me. And so it goes through in multiple cases in the bill and just adds to that the already requirements that already exist if you're in an accident, what you're required to provide with the person you're in the accident with.
Great. Thank you very much.
You bet.
We have questions for Representative Lively. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lively, I'm just curious what provision is made. What's if that person runs into you and cannot prove insurance coverage, then what is the procedure that is followed? You would report that to police, DMV?
DMV. So, Madam Chair, Representative Witt. So now the way the it works, if there's not a person injured in an accident, in many cases in our communities anymore, the police are not involved with it. And so your choices are between the people involved in the accident. And I believe the first thing would happen, it was not, you would call the police and report and do it, that, you know, there had been an accident. And in fact, Don Combs did, in his particular case, he got the police involved trying to find out the insurance, and they did what they could do. There was nothing ultimate they could do to it. But the police probably is the first option for people locally in that to make some kind of report, even though there's not an injured, a person injured in the accident.
Thank you.
Chair.
Yes,
Vice Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you, and Representative Lively. I had a similar incident in the past, and what would the value be of maybe verifying that the person that just hit you is that person, with maybe having a driver's license number added to this or some type of ID?
So, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Meek. So the law already requires. So what the law currently requires is, I'll go back here. So given the name, so they have to require the name of the driver, the registration number of the vehicle and the driver's driving, the name and address of the occupants. That's already required under the law that they provide that information to do it. So what the only piece that wasn't required under there was the insurance piece. So by law, but obviously the issue here is, even though it's the law, you know, laws are only as good as the people willing to follow those laws. And so there's not going to be somebody there. The majority of citizens, if when they get their driver's license or get their insurance card, it says that's one of the requirements, would probably do that. But there'd still be some that would not. But so the current law requires them to give exchange information on their identity and their address and that, but doesn't require they do anything with the insurance.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
My question was verifying that they actually have active driver's license, because giving their information is one thing, but if they don't have, maybe that's not the person that was driving. They gave that's their dad's car or whatever, and they gave their license registration name of their father or whomever. I'm just wondering the value of making it part of the law that they have to, you know, give their driver's license number or something similar to that.
They already have. The way I'm reading this. So. Representative Lively, they already have to give them their name and address, registration number of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. License.
Doesn't say
driver's license.
Driver's license.
No.
In the statute that I'm seeing, is that correct?
I think that's correct. I've got the same statute here.
Yeah.
And
okay.
One of the things I would say, Representative Meek, so in the accident that I was involved with, turned out the vehicle was not owned by the person who was driving the vehicle. It was owned by somebody else. That was not necessary. I did not necessarily know that. The person did know that, and again, there was no trying to hide the information in that. And so it was owned by somebody else, insured by somebody else. In this case, it was a relative of the person that was driving the car. But it all worked because all the information provided. But I appreciate what your question is. I don't know what.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Food for thought. Thank you. Curious.
Yeah.
Any questions? Well, thank you, Representative Lively. I'm sure there'll be more conversation about this. I'm not sure if anybody in the audience from ODOT or DMV has any enlightening comments to make on this, but you're welcome to join us if you do. Nobody else signed up to speak. So, yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Loretta.
Would you be willing to put an amendment in there to add driver's license number to your bill?
I'm very open to that. Sure.
And is there value? I think we will need to.
Sure.
I think there's more conversation to be had, but it makes sense to me that this is common practice. It's expected, and codifying it, I think, makes some sense. But I think we have a little more work to do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason why I was saying that, because my issue that I had an uninsured driver, and I guess his name had changed, and so my insurance company couldn't track him down. But if we would have had the driver's license number or more additional information, because his address had changed, couldn't track him down, it will help our insurance agency track the person that was the victim. But,
very good point.
Okay.
Things
Thank
are
you.
Never as simple as they seem on the surface, are they? Thank you for
We appreciate you bringing this.
Thank sure. you. Thank you.
And I didn't have anyone else sign up to speak to this bill, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2403, and we are going to reopen the informational hearing from the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I believe Ms. Ramsdell is up next.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Amy Ramsdell. I'm the Motor Carrier Division Administrator. I've been with ODOT for almost 19 years now, and I've been in this position for 90 days.
Ah, welcome. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'd like to start first by addressing Representative Vile's question from Wednesday about the vehicle miles traveled by motor carriers. In 2015, we were at 1.8 million miles. In 2014, it was 1.7 million. And if I go back to 2012, it was at 1.6. So there has been a steady increase.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Our division is responsible for regulating the trucking industry in Oregon. We ensure the safety of the motor carriers operating on the highways, and it contributes to the overall safety of the transportation system. Over 70% of Oregon's freight is moved by trucks, and the efficient movement of that freight is vital to our economy. So what does that entail? If we're wearing it, we're driving it, or we're eating it, most likely that traveled on a truck at some point in time. We educate motor carriers, and we enforce federal safety regulations through roadside investigations of the vehicle and the driver, and we also conduct on-site reviews at a motor carrier's place of business. We protect Oregon's infrastructure through our size and weight program. We permit oversized loads throughout the state, and we ensure that they are routed around any obstructions or restricted bridges. Our staff enforce those size and weight restrictions roadside, as well as doing our safety investigations. They also enforce tax and registration requirements. We are responsible for collecting registration fees and weight mile taxes from commercial motor vehicles. We collected over $300 million in weight mile taxes in this last year. We serve over 26,000 motor carriers, representing over 300,000 commercial vehicles traveling in Oregon. We work collaboratively with members of the trucking community. We have a Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee. It provides us with an opportunity to collaborate with members of the industry, DMV CDL program, Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, law enforcement, and others as needed. We also have a Mobility Committee that works collaboratively with trucking industry reps, our Highway Division staff, the Association of General Contractors and local government staff to ensure a safe and efficient movement of freight through Oregon's work zones. Next slide. Give you an overview of our commercial vehicle and driver safety program. Through an annual adoption of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Rules, our staff are charged with conducting those roadside and on-site investigations. Inspections have both an educational as well as an enforcement tone. The examples of things that we look at are our driver's hours of service, load securement, lighting, and hazardous materials. We also participate in public speaking engagements to provide education to the motor carrier industry, and we offer voluntary compliance checks throughout the state. We partner with local and state law enforcement to conduct our roadside inspections after probable cause stops for traffic violations. Using crash data provided by our Transportation Development Division, we've focused our efforts along major freight routes where most truck-at-fault crashes occur. We see this along the interstates and US 97. Our driver added service rate is at 14.5% versus a national standard, which is at 5.5%. This is not a reflection on the industry, but rather it is a reflection on our ability to focus our efforts on those that we need to, given the data we have available roadside. Next slide. Motor carrier enforcement officers work at 88 fixed way stations, which includes ports of entry, and we also have dozens of portable scale sites. Their purpose is to make sure that trucks are staying within size and weight limitations, and also to check those registration and tax credentials. We also partner with the Highway Division staff. During the last winter storms, we were out doing chain enforcement roadside with our maintenance crews. In 2015, our enforcement officers manually weighed over 2 million trucks on our static scales. In Oregon, we have a green light pre-clearance program where we have a transponder inside a vehicle that communicates with our system, and we were able to electronically screen over 1.7 million trucks that maintained highway speed. This is good for the trucking industry, the economy, the environment, and it's a good, efficient use of our resources. The size and weight enforcement program contributes to preserving our infrastructure, as I mentioned earlier. In 2015, we issued 15,000 citations for truck size and weight violations. And in 2015, we issued 19,000 citations for safety and other credential-related violations. So those numbers are relatively small given the large volume of trucks that we have. Our annual oversized overweight permits are issued with the assistance of three counties and two private entities. This public-private partnership allows us to focus our efforts on the single-trip permits where we're routing the oversized loads, and they take care of our annual permits. This is important. This represents about five FTE for me, and so it's a good use of our resources by having those partnerships. We also have agreements in place with all 36 counties to issue permits and collect fees on their behalf and distribute them to them on pre-approved roads. And our mobility committee, as mentioned earlier, plays a critical role in approving highway restriction requests. And we work with our communications section to get information out to truckers nationwide who might be traveling in Oregon. We're committed to providing data to highway project teams to ensure that freight's needs are met in the development of STIP projects. And we work to balance work zone safety with the efficient movement of freight. Vehicle registration and tax. As I mentioned earlier, we collect over $300 million in weight mile taxes annually and over $50 million in registration fees. We participate in an international registration plan and an international fuels tax. This allows motor carriers who are based here in Oregon to do their business with us. They come to a one-stop shop, we register them, and they can operate in all 48 contiguous states and some Canadian provinces. We collect those fees and we distribute them to all of our partners in the other jurisdictions. We have a contact center in Salem. We allow motor carriers to do business with us via phone, fax, mail, email, or online, or in person. Over 80% of Oregon's motor carriers are signed up to do business online. We have over 80,000 services available, or over 80 services, sorry, available online. This allows motor carriers to do business all hours of the day, any day of the week. And to give you an idea of what that represents, over 200,000 of those 300,000 vehicles were renewed online this last year. We're very proud of our online services.
Is that a significant change?
It's been steadily growing over the years, and we continue to add services online. And we do that just to balance our workload. We have an audit program to verify the accuracy of weight mile tax reports and that payments are made by all motor carriers operating in Oregon. In 2016, we reviewed 24,000 of the 26,000 accounts, which resulted in 760 actual full-on weight mile tax audits. This shows a good rate of compliance with our program. As part of our obligations under the International Registration Plan and the International Fuels Tax, we also have to conduct 3% of the motor carrier's accounts need to be audited within a given time period. And we have 4,800 Oregon carriers that participate in that International Registration Plan and International Fuels Tax. This is the end of my presentation, unless you have any questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had a couple things. So one, we had an issue over in Pendleton where Blue Mountain Community College has a CDL program, and then it was taking those that passed the class, it was taking them up to 6 weeks to get their CDL because they had, because I think
they had hired an independent tester to come in to do that, and so they seasonally came around, or if there was there were several people to take the test. And I was wondering, in the state, are there one they would use over there? I think they would use the truck that was owned by the college, you know, for their testing. Mm-hmm. And then it was a pretty rigorous test. I mean, it took a while. But to bring someone over to do the testing, and they had a couple testers, but one tester was off for 6 months, I think, on family leave or something like that. So my question is, are there opportunities throughout the state to take that test if they wanted to, say, travel over to Portland or Salem to take the test and have trucks available for them to take their CDL?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, that'd be a DMV question. It's not always obvious where these things end up, but CDL, the licensure aspect and the testing part, is a DMV responsibility. We do have third-party testers located throughout the state. You don't have to go to the third-party provider in your particular area. You can make arrangements, schedule appointments elsewhere if you're willing to travel. Many of those companies provide the truck, different sizes of truck. We also have DMV offices that still provide CDL testing. It can be a wait to get that scheduled, but we do have many offices that are offering, you know, CDL testing as well, in that particular area as well.
Okay. I have a follow-up question.
Follow-up.
As far as the driver safety programs, is that an ongoing program you have? Is there a cost to that, or do you allow anyone to sign up and take that?
The safety program?
Yeah, you had mentioned up there on one of
Madam Chair.
Please.
Representative
Barreto.
Yeah,
the safety program.
That is an ongoing program. We're required to have that. We certify with Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration that we are inspecting vehicles and the drivers, and that we do that regularly and maintain a minimum level of effort.
So is there a cost? I'm sorry. Is there a cost to that?
Yes. We spend our budget line item, I believe, is about $2 million. I can get you the exact costs after this.
But for me to follow, what is the cost to the driver?
I'll have to follow up on that and see if we can calculate that. Okay.
Thank you. Vice Chair Meek, I believe, had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question about the budgetary process of the $300 million collected. I know there's work on maintaining safety and inspections, but what percentage of that goes into the fund for road maintenance, et cetera? Because I know that is large for this whole, you know, process, that a lot of the use on the roads is from the shipping industry. And what is there any percentage of that funds going to maintenance of the roads?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Meek, I can tell you that $60 million comes off the top for the administration of our division, but to get the exact amount that goes into maintenance, I'd need to check with my counterparts in the highway division.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm just curious.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a question about the voluntary compliance inspections. Is that a program, or is that just kind of a one-off thing? If somebody just has a concern about a particular vehicle or something, or their paperwork or whatever, they call you and say, hey, could you come check this? How does that work?
Madam Chair and Representative Wilson, it depends. They could contact us, and our staff could walk them through what they need. We could go out to their place of business if necessary. But we also advertise events where we have safety staff available, and motor carriers can come to the location and have their trucks inspected. There is a risk, of course, if we find a violation, there's a consequence. But again, it is all voluntary when we do that.
We just follow up.
Yes, sir.
The only thing I can compare that to is in my own radio profession, where we have a program. We don't see the FCC very often. But in light of that, we take advantage of a third-party inspector who will come inspect our facility and everything that we are concerned with. And they will show us any areas that we're in violation. And then we get a period of time to fix those with no penalties involved at all. And then they give us the all clear. They send that certificate to the FCC field office, and we don't see the FCC again for a long time. Now, I know trucking industry, you you have to see them more than the FCC needs to see us. But the attractive part about our program is that we can voluntarily ask to be inspected. The individual, the third party, comes to us and they inspect us. And instead of, you know, having the ability to write us up on the spot, they give us some time to fix that problem free of charge. And then when we comply, they let the FCC know. So I like that. That's a program that's got a heart. So, you know, just a suggestion.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Mr. Gard, let's talk about rail.
I can't. Chairman McHugh and members of the commission, I am sorry I have not yet found all of my voice. I'm still looking for it.
Right behind you.
My name is Hal Gard.
Thank you for
being
here.
I am the administrator of ODOT's Rail and Public Transit Division. I've been with the agency 23 years, but this is my fifth year with Rail and Public Transit. My program really can be summarized in two discrete areas. We're all about safety of rail, and we're all about making sure that folks have opportunities to move around this state without benefit of a single occupancy vehicle. In fact, we used to be two divisions up until 5 years ago when I came, when I took over the divisions. We combined them to great efficiency and found all kinds of opportunities that we didn't know we had. The rail safety part of the house, we address the safety of the railroads that operate within the state. We address the safety of the public highway rail crossings, those points of conflict. And we deal with the safety of rail fixed guideway operations. And as I mentioned the other day, that's a fancy way of talking about light rail, streetcar, and trolley operations. Public transportation, we provide funding, oversight, and technical assistance for public transportation providers throughout the state. We connect communities by providing public transportation services that close service gaps between regions on underserved corridors, and we try to improve the coordination and connections with rail and air services and other transportation providers across the state. We try to increase transportation system capacity by providing information on alternatives to driving alone. And we do all of this work, including the rail work, in cooperation with advisory committees and with the transportation service providers around the state. For rail safety, in 2015, 1.3 million rail carloads of freight originated or passed through Oregon. We have jurisdiction for inspection, enforcement, and industry education to improve statewide rail safety for 2,377 miles of heavy rail track, 82.5 miles of fixed guideway track, and that includes, as I said, light rail, streetcar, and trolley services, 4,800 public and private crossings, which are roughly divided in half, and our responsibilities for those two separate groups. We have a great deal of authority with public crossings. We have a limited amount of authority with private crossings. There are 32 operating railroads that we oversee, and there are 533 rail-served industries that we also have an inspection role for. In addition, we directly manage 155 miles of railroad right-of-way, and we have various other responsibilities. We own the Salem Railroad Station. We provide planning services, oversee our modal development plans for rail, that type of thing. Rail safety program, the inspection program itself, it includes two discrete programs. The heavy rail program is administered consistent with the Federal Rail Administration regulations, and we actually work in concert with FRA and augment their staff across the state. State Safety Oversight Program focuses on the fixed rail guideways. Is administered per Federal Transit Administration regulations, and that is a relatively new and evolving program. We've had state oversight, state rules for quite a while, but the FTA active role in that enforcement is only a few years old, and so we'll be talking as that program continues to evolve. We utilize a combination of inspections, enforcement actions, industry education, audit, development of safety, security, and emergency plans and review and compliance with those plans to improve rail safety. The idea is to really to reduce rail incidences across the state. really focused on the potential release of hazardous materials through any significant incident, and to make sure that we're reducing and minimizing the number of accidents for the public transportation aspects of rail. Our areas are the safety piece is really very, very specialized. FRA will only allow us to certify an inspector in particular areas. So we have inspectors in motor power and equipment, folks that look at the cars and the locomotives, track specialists, signals and train control specialists, operations specialists, as well as hazardous material specialists across the state. We will look at track conditions such as switches, rail ties, uneven track, focus on rail cars for proper packaging, marking, valve closures, that type of thing. It's fairly all-encompassing. We do not have an emergency response role, so our two areas are really focused upon prevention. And then we have a accident investigation role. So we will be on site after an emergency, but we're not part of the cleanup and all of that work. We're really there to try to figure out what caused it so that we can then focus our attention in the appropriate areas. Crossing safety program enforces state and federal laws regulating crossing safety with a goal of minimizing the negative impacts at those critical conflict points where the highways meet the railroads. We have an annual inspection of all of our public crossings, and then we are continuing to try to catch up on all of our private crossings across the state. And additionally, we administer the crossing order process for the public crossings, and that really is a process of program reviews and working out really in a negotiated agreement between the railroad and the road authorities with regard to the appliances, steps, and operations of every particular crossing. And little did I know that while that's a fairly quiet program most of the time, it's the area that will get you guys a phone call from an angry constituent if there's a problem around crossing safety. So public transportation funding and oversight. We've got a role with rural general public transportation across the state, inner-city passenger transportation, transportation for seniors and individuals with disabilities, capital facilities and bus replacements, and transportation demand management and transit planning programs statewide. As of September 2016, the public transit section was actively administering 332 grants with 103 unique recipients totaling just over $95 million. Our work supports the provision of public transportation in more than 200 cities, towns, many unincorporated areas, and with the 9 federally recognized Indian tribal areas. We work with every single county in the state of Oregon. In 2015, the Oregon Public Transportation System delivered 131 million trips across the state, using a fleet of over 2,000 vehicles. 50% of those vehicles were purchased with either state or federal funds, which passed through that section. And we actually have fee title to that 1,000 vehicles, so we are actually the owners of those vehicles that are in service. Our intercity transit and passenger rail programs connect cities and regions, providing public transportation over longer distances. Programs serve both transit-dependent and choice riders, and they include both residents and visitors. We manage agreements with private contractors to provide intercity public transportation services on the Amtrak Cascade service, our five-point intercity bus routes, and the Columbia Gorge Express bus service. And I want to emphasize here that we're not in competition with private providers such as Greyhound and Bolt, but we do want to make sure there is service available. So when Greyhound no longer found it profitable to serve folks from Bend to Burns, we put in an intercity route so that those folks did have some way to get out of Burns if they did not have a other route available to them. Amtrak Cascade service connects 18 cities in the Pacific Northwest along the 466-mile rail corridor. It spans from Eugene to Vancouver, British Columbia. There are 124 miles of that service between Portland and Eugene. The Amtrak Cascades Intercity Passenger Rail Service served 113,000 passengers in 2016, and there were an additional 500,000 boardings or detrainings at stations in Oregon on their way to or from the state. We own and maintain two of the seven train sets that comprise the Amtrak Cascades fleet, with WashDOT and Amtrak owning the other five train sets. Each year, Oregonians take roughly 1.3 million rides, as I mentioned earlier, on public transportation. We provide the funding, the oversight, and the technical assistance to public transportation providers across the state. In 2015, we administered $65.4 million in state and federal funds out of the approximately $794 million that were expended on public transportation throughout the state. The remaining funds came from federal funds provided directly to large urban providers or from local funding from passenger fares. And while this seems like a great deal of money, recent work on our developing public transportation plan indicates that we're nowhere near the need, that really the state needs about $1 billion a year in order to continue to grow the service and meet the demand, maintain what our fleet replacement schedules across the state. Right now we continue to see a declining service, loss of weekend service, loss of evening service. So it's an ongoing struggle to try to keep up.
Would you repeat that?
So we've
$1 billion.
That's the estimate in terms of continue to grow the need within the state. We're looking at about $1 billion a year in order to be able to continue to do that.
An annual investment
across the state
into the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and that's for all service providers. That's not for the state of Oregon, but that includes TriMet and Lane and Salem Kaiser and, you know, our large and small urban providers as well as our rural providers.
The rural as well.
Correct. It's a statewide need.
Thank you. It's just a really big number.
It is a big number. It's a very big number. General Public Transportation Program funds transit services befitting the general public in rural areas, as well as bus and bus facilities providers across the state. And our Special Transportation Needs Program provides the public transportation service to seniors and individuals with disabilities, enabling access to health care, education, work, social opportunities. Program funds a range of fixed route transit services as well as demand response services that actually provides door-to-door service for those folks with particular needs. State funding for the program is the main source of local match for many of the smaller providers that do not have any source of local funds, which allows them to leverage federal funds. And that concludes my presentation, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Representative Wilson, please.
Yes, Mr. Gard, no need to answer this question today.
Okay.
I thought only radio people got what you got. That's ugly. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd like to talk with you one of these days about the relationship with the rail companies. And so if you're over in the House wings one of these days, if you'd look me up, I'd appreciate that. I'd like to gain a little more intel there.
My absolute pleasure.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gard, I think you said there were 116,000 rail passengers in 2016.
Chair McKeown, Representative Witt, 113,000 approximately.
113,000. And what's the average load factor per rail car? What percent would be filled?
Oh, you're talking about freight. You're talking about
passengers.
And passenger rail.
Chair McKeown, Representative Witt, but the passenger rail cars are quite light. I mean, but if we're talking capacity in terms of passengers, a train set has about 182 seats per trip. So that's available.
And how many cars is that?
13 cars per train set.
So of those 182, how many seats are would be filled, say, Eugene to Portland?
I can get you, Chairman Kuhn and Representative Witt, I can get you a breakdown on what the daily trip. It varies, depends upon which time, which route, which day, which particular train is moving. I will tell you that we are the money run. The majority of the riders are moving between Portland and Seattle. That's where the population is, and that's where the high demand is. We currently aren't there. Our trains are not running at full capacity at this time. We've seen steady growth. We've seen steady interest, but we have capacity in that area.
I can tell you that I sometimes ride the train between Longview and Salem, and ridership's fairly high, but I would be curious, too, what the average state subsidy per seat would be.
Absolutely. We can get you those numbers.
And Representative Witt, this is a topic of conversation every session, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but the state subsidizes this service to a very high degree.
We do.
And I'm not going to get the number right off the top of my head. It's around $20 million. Is that close?
Chairman Kuhn, Representative Witt, the general fund contribution to the Amtrak's Cascade service is $10 million a biennium. Mm-hmm. The remainder of that money is coming from...
It is significant. It's an ongoing topic of conversation.
It is.
We are not an East Coast corridor where we have this very dense population center. So this is something that we discuss on a regular basis about the value of that service, and it's a bit of a head-scratcher at times.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Yes. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. This is a comment and a question as well. The comment is that, especially as the Chair talked about, we're not in the East Coast, and one of the things in the West is the chicken or the egg. Most of our rail, as I understand it, is actually industry-driven in terms of its usage. And the way that the tracks are, often industry, at least up until recent times, has taken priorities if there was a necessary thing going on. And the certainty and consistency of rail has always been an issue. If it's not, thankfully we don't do what Italy used to do and shoot people if it's not on time, but it is on time in Italy. So when you move schedules, you move times, it really does impact people because they start, if they set that up as their way to get to and from places, they rely on it. And one of the things I hope that we look at as we move forward on a larger transportation discussion is the value of certainty and consistency for public transportation. It's not always obvious, but it takes a while for habit patterns to get in place, and it takes a while for habit patterns to actually fill up the seats. The question really is, I know over the last 3 years there's been a lot of hard work done by Oregon and the national agencies on trying to make sure that trains can be more consistent, that they're not put on the side in lieu of a freight or things like that. I'd like to have a conversation, or maybe there is a report available, of the steps that's been taken over the last 3 years to improve quality of service for folks going out there, so we can, as we look at these things, make sure that we're telling and sharing the good news with our constituents about some of the concrete steps that have been taken. So that's a request.
Chairman Kuhn, Representative Evans, I appreciate that. And we provide a quarterly report to the legislature on the work we've done. In 2015, we had an awful downturn in on-time performance, and we were charged with turning that around. And I think we've had some pretty good success.
Mm-hmm.
We still have a ways to go.
And we want to help tell that story so people actually increase their ridership. That's the goal.
I appreciate that. And just, if I may, real quickly, while passenger rail does have priority over freight, we don't dispatch those trains. The host railroad is responsible for the dispatching. So there are frequently conflicts depending upon the length of train and availability of sidings.
Right.
But we do have a good working relationship with our host railroad.
And Representative Evans, I think it's been multiple sessions now. We have constituents call us and say, why are we not double tracking the Willamette Valley to avoid these conflicts?
A lot of money.
But the cost of doing that, including obtaining right-of-ways and building it, is just astronomical. So when people call, that would be a very difficult thing to do.
Yep.
But I would like to in a very good light, we've seen these reports over the last few years, and Mr. Gardzoff, they've done a remarkable job of dealing with the issue of performance. It has increased dramatically, and I'm sure Hal would be happy to share those reports with us. If you send them to Tim, he can send them out, because they've done a really great job of addressing that issue, and we're very proud of it.
Absolutely.
Yes, Vice Chair Mile.
Did you have something?
No, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm going to pass. I'll ask him another time.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Amy, for coming with the statistics on the motor carrier, the freight carriers. Of that remaining 30%, I'm curious how much of that remaining 30% of our freight is going over rail in the state, if we know.
I don't know. I'm going to have to find out.
Madam Chair and Representative Vile.
I might be able to look it up for you.
Let me look.
Please, Amy.
Rail.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll get back to you and get some numbers from PDD.
Any other questions? Representative Bretto, did you have something?
Well, you know, I was going to ask about oil on the rail. And I know that was a federal issue in the Gorge last week. There's people concerned over where we are about spills. And in La Grande, in the last 30 years since I've been there, I think there's been four or five derailments right there at our place of business. So three of those, I think, were caused by excessive wind against the rail cars. And then I saw this picture up here of the containers double stacked, you know, and if they're which when you look at the engineering on that, you know, the skinny rails and the high, you think, man, how do those things stay on around corners, you know? But on the when they transport that stuff with oil, is it just a train that just has oil, or do they mix and match the cars so they are susceptible, like those containers look like?
Chair McHugh and Representative Barreto, there are mixed manifest trains, but in general, the crude oil trains are called key trains, and they are a single commodity train. That's the major efficiency, where you can just bring one train in, fill it, one train and offload it at a facility.
Okay, thank you.
Unit trains. Any other questions? Thank you very much. I'm sure that we will be seeing you again in the very near future. We appreciate your expertise and your skill and the work that you do, and we appreciate you being here this morning. And you go home.
Thank you very much.
Get back to bed. I will adjourn our informational meeting, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2291. Turn to Mr. Walker to enlighten us.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2291 clarifies that there is no exemption for heavy truck regulations for farm vehicles that carry hazardous material loads in interstate commerce. Allows the Department of Transportation enforcement officers to issue citations for violation of obscuring truck license plates on out-of-state vehicles, and changes weight calculation methodology for commercial buses with respect to weight mile taxes. The revenue and fiscal statements have not been requested yet, so we will not have an opportunity to move this today.
Thank you very much. And I believe we have Ms. Joyce and Mr. McCain. Sorry, I couldn't read it very well. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. I'm Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Talking today about three items in House Bill 2291. One of those items has to do with hazardous materials, and so with me is our resident expert, Mr. David McCain, who's the safety manager for our Motor Carrier Transportation Division. Submitted a written piece of testimony, but really this comes to you in three parts. I'm going to take the two easier parts
please.
First. First, as Mr. Walker noted, what we're looking for is to add to the statute the ability for our motor carrier enforcement officers at our ports of entry and weigh station, the ability to cite when a truck has an obscured license plate. So the statute currently has 20-some items where our officers can issue a citation to a trucker, but not for obscuring of license plates. Sometimes this is an inadvertent problem, but, you know, certainly sometimes there's a bit of gamesmanship going on, and that plate can't really be seen very well, either by an individual or the plate reader cameras that are located within our ports of entry. And what that means is a real lack of efficiency. So trucks roll through kind of at a slow roll through our way stations and ports of entry, and our folks are in the station keying in information, making folks have paid their weight mile tax. They're not overweight, they're not over length, and any number of other things, and we keep that going at a slow roll. If we can't see that license plate, we stop the whole line of trucks. The guys or gals in the way station get out of the building, go out, find the license plate, go back in, key it in, and the whole thing comes to a halt. So we believe that if we have the ability to cite for this kind of an infraction, that it will drive enforcement by folks, and we'll be able to keep those lines of trucks rolling through our way stations and be more efficient in what we do. The second item has to do with standardizing the way we calculate weight for all of heavy vehicles across the portfolio. So all except one of the heavy motor vehicles that we regulate, we use the gross vehicle weight rating, the GVWR, for calculating weight mile tax and registration for that vehicle. There's an outlier. It's commercial passenger buses. There's an arcane formula in statute that has to do with the number of seats on a bus, and presuming that we all weigh an average of 170 pounds and use that formula to calculate the weight of a bus. It is likely inaccurate. It's not consistent with the other heavy vehicles on the road, so those vehicles are probably paying just a little bit less than their fair share. And it's rather inefficient to have everybody else using this kind of weight over here, the GVWR, and then this small group of vehicles using this formula to calculate weight. We'd like to see that unified, and just everybody, the gross vehicle weight rating, your GVWR, that's the weight we're going to use across the portfolio. We think that makes sense. The third item comes to us from a routine audit that was conducted by the FMCSA, Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. And they're seeking to make sure that states are in compliance with federal law, because the vast majority of our regulations that we enforce come to us from the federal government. So we got that audit, had a few things that needed to be corrected. We did all of those except for one, which requires a statutory fix. And here's the situation. If you have a farm vehicle conducting an intrastate commerce, which is extremely rare, and they're hauling hazardous materials, the federal auditors decided that our statute isn't clear enough to say that those folks need to be meeting the federal hazmat regulations just like everybody else. They view our statute as giving a bit of a free pass to farm vehicles in intrastate commerce, and the feds basically say nobody gets a free pass on hazmat. So the change in the bill seeks to make clear that, again, farm trucks in intrastate commerce hauling hazardous materials need to meet those federal regulations. It's essentially a paperwork question. Is the jug of pesticide or fertilizer properly marked? The manufacturer is going to have that marked. In the cab of the truck, do you have a list saying what kinds of nasty things you're carrying, so that if there's an accident, the first responders can know what you're carrying and know what kind of problem they're dealing with? And if you're hauling a whole lot of this stuff in a tank, you need to have one of those diamond placards on it, again, telling first responders and drivers around you what kind of nasty stuff you're carrying. That's the proposal. The lack of being in compliance with what the federal auditors wanted means that we cannot apply for federal MCSAP funding. MCSAP stands for Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program. So every year we can't apply for that grant. We're leaving about $3.5 million in money on the table, and that money can be used for safety enforcement either by ourselves, our motor carrier enforcement officers, or we can grant it out to law enforcement agencies. That's the proposal in the bill, and we welcome any questions.
Vice Chair Vile.
I want to make sure I understand the relating clause for this bill talks about gross vehicle weights over 26,000. And are we talking about then a situation where a farmer puts a gallon or a 5-gallon jug of a hazardous material in the back of a pickup and is traveling from one farm to another? Would that be regulated under the proposal?
That didn't take long. Madam Chair, Representative Vile, Amy did a wonderful job explaining
Sir,
this, but like...
I'll need to have you identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is David McCain. I'm a member of the Motor Carrier Transportation Division, and I manage the Oregon Truck Safety Program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Vile, it's difficult to explain in a short document all of the exceptions, whether it's a safety rule or a hazardous material rule. So I'll try to answer the question this way. There is a state statute in Chapter 823 that says the transportation of hazardous materials is regulated in Oregon, and we can apply those regulations to everybody. There's another portion in statute that exempts farmers from certain things. We don't specifically say hazardous materials. So a little more detail on the conflict that the federal government shared with us. The hazardous materials that we're talking about, as you can imagine, are pesticides, perhaps fuel for the tractors and things of that nature. Would it apply to every hazardous material? I'd hate to say this, but it depends on what that hazardous material is. For example, the farmers will still enjoy the exemption when they go from the farm to the field, or where they go from the field to another field. What we're talking about here is the transportation of these hazardous materials, perhaps poisons, flammables, that travel other than from the farm to the field. Maybe there's a trip to the co-op to pick up 5-gallon buckets of concentrate pesticide. That the regulations that would apply to that would simply mean that the container that the pesticide comes in has to be marked to say what is in it, and one would think that would come from the manufacturer. There would have to be a piece of paper in the truck that says what hazardous material is in the truck, and one would think that would come from the co-op where you purchased it from. And those are pretty much it. If you have a large quantity of these hazardous materials, perhaps then the additional communication marking of the placard, the diamond. So it would depend on what the item is and how much you have. We believe that this is being complied with today because, as Amy indicated in her testimony, we've never thought that the farmers were exempt. We have two folks that work with the farmers, the Farm Bureau and the Oregon Wheat Growers League, for example. But it's purely a communication requirement. So as you come from the co-op to the farm, there's maybe a motor vehicle crash, the first responders show up, that they have an understanding that, hey, there's something in the truck that may not react well to water if there's a fire. But once the commodity gets to the farm, there's an exemption that exists today that will remain that, you know, as I said earlier, farm to the field, field to field, the regulations would not apply.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Thanks, David. I appreciate that. But I'm still puzzled a bit.
Okay.
We're talking about a situation where maybe the co-op drops 4 totes off at the main facility for a farmer. And that farmer's got 4 or 5 different locations that they're working, either owned or leased farms, maybe 6 or 8 miles apart in some cases on fairly well-traveled public highways. We pick up 1 tote that with a forklift, it fits in the back of a pickup truck. We're certainly well under 26,000 pounds. We've got no particular markings on that other than maybe what were put on there by the manufacturer or the supplier. and we drive that truck 6 miles to another farm. If we're pulled over there and we don't have paperwork in the truck that shows maybe some of the things that the feds are requiring, what's the result?
Well, if we were to inspect you, one of our roadside facilities, the result would be that we would list it as a violation, and that would be the result. I'm just trying to. Would it perhaps are we talking maybe a pesticide, a fertilizer?
Typically, a pesticide or a
herbicide.
Or an herbicide. Uh-huh.
Okay, and I'm sorry, Representative Vile. What quantities were we talking about?
Well, I'm talking about. I don't remember what the gallonage is, but we get our herbicides in a plastic tote with a metal frame around it, approximately a rectangular or a, and I don't know what the volume is. What do you think that is?
No.
150 gallons? I don't know.
But that tote would be coming from the co-op, for example.
We may get 6 totes delivered. For example, I have this experience on my own farm. We may get multiple totes delivered to one location, and we've got to take one of those totes to another location that's about 6 miles by public road away, and we'll just load it in the back of a pickup truck. And we're typically not putting in paperwork. Our guys are not, at this point at least, trained to understand that they've got to make sure that they've got paperwork for every time they pull a bit of something from one farm to another.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Vile, the paperwork that we're talking about would simply just be a document that identifies what is in that packaging. And I would have to believe that packaging or that tote is already marked on what is in it. So that's the communication piece. The driver's license your driver may have, which may be not a CDL because it's a farm operation, the statute is very clear. They're allowed to haul hazardous material with the farm endorsed driver's license, so that's not impacted. It would just simply be having something with the truck that says what is it that is hazardous, and then having the package properly marked, again, what is in the package that is hazardous.
For some reason, I'm still hung up on the fact that we have in the relating clause the 26,000-pound remark, and I fear that there could be a lot of confusion around what is really being asked of the farmer unless we clarify this.
Right. If I may, Madam Chair.
Please.
Madam Chair, Representative Vile, so I think I see where you're going. So the relating clause is relating to vehicles weighing more than 26,000 pounds. And in your questions, you're specifically saying we're talking about a pickup and a tote that's under 26,000. So I think the question then for us is, vehicle under 26,000 but hauling hazmat, do these rules apply? And I think our answer is yes, it's supposed to. And then I think the natural follow-up question is, does that provision fit within this relating clause, which we know legally it must? I think that's an excellent question for legislative counsel.
Representative McLean.
Well, I want to put aside the relating clause because I agree with you on that. But I just want to be clear about this. This is not a new rule. This is a federal rule, and that it's not a new rule, it's a federal rule, and the state of Oregon has been told that we need to clean up our education aspect of this so people know it's a rule. Most people are doing this right now. What, 85, 90, 95%? If they are large trucks, they have the little triangle that says hazardous waste or a hazardous, you know, fertilizer or whatever the, I don't know what the sign says, but there's something that says hazard on the side of the truck. If it's small, all you're asking them to do is have it in original containers or have it in containers that have a list of what's inside. That's not new. There's nothing there new. So it's federal. We're being told we're not doing something. So I guess what I'm asking is, when we pass or don't pass this bill, what is the problem solved or the problem still there?
Money. Chair McEwen and Representative McLean, I think the main problem is leaving $3.5 million on the table, federal dollars on the table.
I think that's a big problem.
For safety enforcement. As Mr. McCain indicated, his enforcement folks have been considering this applicable to intrastate commerce as well.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to make the point that this isn't a situation where either the federal government or our state enforcement officers identified a problem with, you know, people recklessly carrying hazardous materials or having a number of crashes or anything of that nature. In fact, I think our data shows that we don't see a problem with farm crashes, let alone farm crashes involving hazardous mm-hmm. materials. So it's not an issue of identifying a problem in that way and trying to address it. It's merely addressing a federal audit finding and making sure we're able to apply and receive those significant grant dollars.
So just one follow-up. So that's my point. To me, this looks like we're just cleaning up for the federal government that we are doing this. And so we are reasserting what the rule is. The rule is if you're small, it has to have on the container what's in it. And if it's large, it has to have a triangle or something on the outside of the truck, probably over the 26,000 or 26,000, whatever your little scale is. And it has to have some kind of a sign on the side of the big truck. I mean, it doesn't seem like a big deal. It's already there. It's already required. All we're trying to do is make sure we don't lose resources from the federal government.
Representative Wilson, and then back to Vice Chair Bile.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The relating clause notwithstanding, I thought that I heard that this would really only apply to the transportation of this material between the co-op and the farm. It would not apply from farm to farm.
Chair McEwen and Representative Wilson, yeah, I'd like Mr. McCain to address that specifically, but as he was mentioning in his conversation with Representative Vile, there is a federal exception, and therefore it would be part of what the Oregon law effectively is that between farms, then you don't have to comply with this hazardous material regulation. Is that a fair statement, Dave?
But the question then becomes, is it between farms on a privately owned road? If you're going out on a county highway or a state highway, is it different? I think, is that where you're headed?
Yeah, I think so.
What does it mean to go between farms?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, if I may, I can read the exemption. It's two sentences. And I would warn you that it's open to interpretation. It simply says, if you are a farmer transporting agricultural products other than gases, Class 2, so maybe anhydrous ammonia wouldn't apply. But if you're transporting products between fields of the same farm using local roads, you do not comply with any of the requirements. So this, a discussion that we had just the other day with the Farm Bureau is, well, what is a local road?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say my interpretation would be a local road is a road that is near your farm that you get to your fields with.
Mm-hmm. Not Highway 97 or Highway 99.
Well,
but that's the problem.
Exactly. That's what we're trying. That's where I'm headed. So that's open to interpretation by the regulator then, and by the farmer. Vice Chair Bile.
I'll pass.
I have two questions. One is, what constitutes notice in the cab of the truck? Could I take a piece of paper and write anhydrous ammonia 300 pounds on here and set it on the dashboard?
Madam Chair, the simple answer is yes, as long as you had all the required information.
You don't have to get anything from anybody. You just have to have something on there that says what it is that's visible.
That's correct.
Okay. Secondly, on the relating to clause, I think, and Ms. Joyce, tell me if I'm wrong, the relating to clause has three parts. You have a semicolon after 2,600 pounds, which is the first section, which is the Waymaster enforcement. Then you have a semicolon after creating new provisions, which is the bus designation, and another semicolon. And then you have a third section of the relating to clause, which is the amendment for what we're talking about with the hazardous materials, which is 8.25.026, and those provisions. So really, they're all in the relating to clause. Is that correct? Am I reading that correctly?
Chair McEwen, I think could easily make the argument that relating to motor vehicles weighing more than 26,000 pounds really does incorporate this because it's getting rid of an exception. But I would say that I think this is a question for legislative counsel. They are the experts on relating to clauses, and I would absolutely defer to their decision.
Representative McLean.
It's the fact that you've got it in a list and you've also got the semicolons, right?
Three sections to the bill.
Yeah.
Three sections to what you're trying to alter.
I mean, I agree with Ms. Joyce that I think you need to ask that legal question because grammatically, it's a list, mm-hmm. and you've got the separation of punctuation.
Mm-hmm. So we'll figure that out. Representative Barreto had a comment.
Mm-hmm. So what is the level of violation if you get caught with this, and then what would be the fine that you'd be fined for this violation?
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, if we were to inspect, if ODOT staff were to inspect a vehicle that was carrying a hazardous material and didn't have perhaps the paperwork in the cab that was required, I'm not certain we would cite. It would simply be a violation. If a police officer on the side of the road were to stop a vehicle and for whatever reason determine that there was a communication requirement not present, they could possibly cite. I don't know what the bail would be. I'm certain it would. I guess I don't know. I would owe you an answer. But what ODOT does when our division administrator was talking, predominantly we inspect the vehicles, we list the violations, and then we expect the motor carrier, in this case the farmer, to make the correction and provide that document back to us certifying the correction was made.
Sounds like it's in the spirit of what happens with the FCC.
Or OSHA.
We do need to move along. We have other people who want to testify on this bill, and we're running very short on time. I'm sure we will be having more discussions about this, and I think, Ms. Joyce, between you and Mr. Walker, can you kind of investigate the questions that have come up, and I'm sure we'll be having you back.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to call up Mr. Beyer and Ms. Fast, please. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Seed Council and also here to speak for the Oregon Farm Bureau, as is Ms. Fast also, I think. So here to testify in opposition to the bill, but only to Sections 5 and 6 of the bill. I think that's the sections you've just been discussing. As our farmers are moving hazardous products to and from the fields, I guess, and there's confusion about that, whether it's to and from fields or it's only from the store to the fields or to the operation. I think the questions and answers that were just generated by the panel and the answers generated by the Department of Transportation show the confusion in this area and what we fear our farmers will be subject to. When or when I do not have to placard, what size vehicle is under this regulation? There are at least six different placards for different materials, and each one of those materials have a different amount regulation that you are required to placard for, or maybe you aren't, depending on which vehicle it is put in. So this is very confusing. I don't think it's as simple as just fixing an audit issue. I'd like to dive into that deeper. Our understanding was there has been no federal funds lost by this. This audit is actually quite old, is my understanding, so it's been around for a while. But it just seems like it's a problem or a solution in search of a problem to us. There has been no problems, no safety issues that we're aware of. I think you just heard the same thing. But also, I think we need to focus on the relating to clause issue. The relating to clause clearly is relating to motor vehicles weighing more than 26,000 pounds, semicolon. That is the relating to clause. Everything after that semicolon can and is regularly changed by legislation as you amend bills. So anything that is not fit into that statement cannot be in this bill by the Oregon Constitution. And if that provision applies to vehicles of less than 26,000 pounds, that clearly cannot be a part of this legislation. It's that simple. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Part of a solution if there is one needed.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the legal opinion there. My question is, if an audit is old, we shouldn't follow it?
Madam Chair, Representative Evans, I believe that this audit doesn't cost the state anything. There are lots of federal laws and federal regulations that we don't have in our books.
So we should wait until it does.
Madam Chair, Representative Evans, I believe this is a solution in search of a problem.
Representative McLean.
Well, we're going to take care of the clause. We're going to find out, you know, from our lawyers what that means. And so, you know, I think you can feel comfortable that that's going to be taken care of. But one thing you did say, I heard the panel right before you saying that there's another issue. And even though there may not have been funds lost, we don't want funds lost or the opportunity for us not to be able to, you know, try for money or for grants. And so I think I would disagree with that one part of your statement that we need to be thorough, not just about the clause, not just about concerns about clarity, because we definitely need clarity. And I agree with you on that, that we have to look at what size, what kind of a sign and a sign on what. You know, so I think we'll be talking about that. But I do believe that the staff has brought us a concern that we want to make sure we're not doing anything that's going to lose federal types of resources that we might want or need or want to apply for. But the rest of it, I think we both clearly said we're interested in making sure we have clarity and absolutely, you know, people have to know what they're supposed to do and when and how and if, is it reasonable.
Ms. Fast.
Good morning. For the record, Katie Fast with Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I think there's been a great discussion today. And I think part of what our request to the committee is you also look at not only the federal side of things, but what the implication to the agricultural community is in this legislation. And I'd like to give some examples of where that confusion is. Because as Roger mentioned, there are six different signs that require posting for. In the terms of pesticide use, there isn't one sign just for pesticide containers. A farmer would have to look through a book, pretty thick, to determine if he is carrying a flammable or just a poisonous, and which placard needs to go on, or multiple. I spoke with a local co-op that is required to do this now. They have one person on their staff of, you know, many people that specializes in this to make sure all their postings are done correctly. Additionally, the confusion that this proposal gives around when you're in and when you're out. Field to field, exempt. But if I decide I'm going to stop in and pick up parts as I'm traveling field to field, if I'm going to grab a hamburger or something at a convenience store along the road, then I am now out because I have not gone just field to field. Additionally, if I go to my co-op in rural Rickrail, Oregon, and pick up products and then take it to the farm I'm in, but if I go to the field right next to that co-op in between that field to field, then I'm out. And so we're very concerned about the lack of clarity around the regulation. There are certain things within the proposal that, you know, I think that you can still have the safety requirements in. The products that we're carrying on the pesticide side of things are all required to maintain in their original packaging with the labels of what's on them on the outside. So if there is an accident, that is all there for law enforcement to be able to find out. However, as you've heard, there is not a concern in terms of the safety side of this. This is really a paperwork trail that is going to be put on the burden of the farmer to make sure they're in compliance with and have vulnerability with as well. So with that, I think we're both happy to answer any more questions.
Other questions? Well, I think we will be having more conversations about this bill. And on that note, in the spirit of trying to be efficient with our time, thank you for being here today. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2291. Anything else for the good of the order today? Then I will turn to Mr. Walker and give us the rundown of what we will be doing on Wednesday.
Yes. Let me bring up an agenda. Momentarily. Madam Chair, members of the committee. On Wednesday, we will have an informational meeting with the Oregon Travel Information Council.
As you want, Greg.
And we will have public hearings on House Bill 2289, 2022, and 2695.
And on that note, we are adjourned. Enjoy your weekend, everybody. And on that note, we are adjourned. Enjoy your weekend, everybody.